Hi, this is Arnie Artisan, and this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Artisan and producer Ken Barnes. Wow, it's 4th of July weekend. We're actually Zooming this on Sunday, the day after 4th of July. It was interesting to sort of watch the fireworks and things coming out of the mouth of our president. But before we get into the 4th of July, July 5th, and of course this is going to air on July 6th, we have to remind everyone that on this radio show for the last couple of months and until November of 2020, you'll be hearing the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearing of 2019. If you want to know what a patriot sounds like, if you want to know someone that makes you proud, then listen to the testimony.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Okay, gang. Rethink the week. Maybe it just should be just rethink the weekend because it was just crazy. Joining us for our Rethink the Week is a wonderful group of guests. We have joining us, as he does virtually every Monday, Dean Spiliotis. He is a presidential scholar and a civics scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. He also is a regular on New Hampshire Public Radio for their end of the week roundtable, and he has a blog site called nhpoliticalcapital.com. Welcome to the program, Dean.
Hi, Arnie. Good to see you.
Good to see you. Joining us from very far away, but someone who used to live in Concord, New Hampshire, is Royal Ford. As he reminded me, not only is he a native of Concord, New Hampshire, but he is the grandson of a B&M railroad yards worker and the son of a stone cutter from Swenson's, which I think shut down, Royal. Am I right? I think Swenson's has shut down.
I don't know if it closed or not.
Yeah, I think it has. But he began his career in journalism at the Claremont Daily Eagle. He spent 30 years. This is unbelievable. I don't know anyone can say that anymore. 30 years at the Boston Globe, where he was everything from their, the national politics editor. You then cover New England. And when I got to meet you, you were covering cars and car culture at the Boston Globe. So welcome from Portugal, Royal Ford. It's a pleasure to have you
here again.
And Stephen Pimpere is at UNH. He is a senior fellow at the Carsey Institute. His area of expertise is homelessness and poverty and all the things that are sort of rearing its ugly head because of the growing inequality, the pandemic, the economic downturn. So your level of expertise is probably more in demand now, Stephen, than ever before. Thank you for coming.
Hi, Arnie. Good to be here.
All right. So I just want to share something kind of quirky. And you may have seen this, on my Facebook page. But it was kind of emotional, and I want to just share some of the responses. So this was on Twitter, and then I put it on my Facebook page, and it's gotten hundreds of people responding. And here was the question. Without saying your age, say something from your childhood. Okay? So I wrote, Dad, the National Geographic has arrived. And in my family, you never throughout a National Geographic, you're waiting for it, you ripped off the brown cover, you pulled out the map. It was almost like sacred text, and it came all the time. So that was my memory from childhood. But I want to share a couple of the memories because one, some of them are incredibly emotional, but two, they will make you smile. Here's one of them. Hello, operator, I'm in Manchester. Can you connect me with Nashua? Number tuxedo, yada, yada, yada. Oh my God. Or this one from Jocelyn. It's my turn to lick the green stamps and put them in the book. One of my favorites, Ginny, this would be me. Kids in school, did you see the Beatles on TV last night? me, you watched Bugs on television? Or how about this one? Mom, what's our ring from the party line? Or Keith, Walter Cronkite is off. Our silence ended when he said, and that's the way it was. And then I will end with this. Doug wrote, did you hear the Russians shot down a weather plane? That, of course, was the U-2 spy plane that was going over Soviet airspace. I think it was in 1977. But of course, they called it the weather plane. So you should just read some of them. Just one more. And Joel wrote, I remember the beatings about how he was hit by his father. And just to let you know, you guys, as soon as he wrote that, I too had been physically abused by my mother especially. And I said, was it the strap, the hairbrush, or the ham? And he said, sadly, Arnie, there were five boys. It was a 2x4. So just amazing how people were funny and emotional and whatever. So just to give you an idea, that's my aside. Now for my favorite. I never knew where this word came from, but now I do. In Athenian democracy, there was a system where citizens could vote to exile a politician for 10 years. It was called ostracism. The pottery shards, ostraca, were used as voting tokens. The nominated person had 10 days to leave the city. So Dean Spiliotis, I wrote, got shards? I got a name. So I'm going to start with you, Dean. It was an interesting 4th of July. And if you did a split screen between Donald Trump and Joe Biden, you swore you were on different planets. You saw you were looking at a different country. You swore that one man only saw one group of individuals that he wanted to talk to, while the other one felt a need to sort of talk to a country as a whole. So your reactions to sort of the Trump-Biden split.
Yeah, it really was remarkable. A holiday that we typically think of as the country coming together, you know, to celebrate our history. And we have these great traditions, not only barbecues, but fireworks and parades and people wearing red, white, and blue, all the kinds of things that typically unite us as a country. It was remarkable for me to see the overtness and depth of the split that is taking shape in our country. You know, Trump gave two speeches, one at Mount Rushmore, one in Washington, both just remarkably divisive, hitting themes of racial division, cultural division, religious division, just very divisive. And then simultaneously going on at the same time, hearing from others on the other side, so to speak, more openly than I ever have been before, how, you know, African Americans arguing that 4th of July doesn't speak to them the way that it does to white Americans. Lots of readings of Frederick Douglass's famous commentary on what the 4th of July means to a slave. People taking down statues that continued. Black Lives Matter's protests. It was the holiday to me felt unlike. I mean, we got the pandemic on top of all of this, but even if you took the pandemic out, and I think they're interrelated to some extent, how we're handling this and how we're all behaving, but even kind of focusing more on the political aspect of things, it just was it's such a dissonant feel to the holiday in comparison to what for me was always one of my favorite holidays growing up.
Exactly.
To feel good about being an American. And everywhere you turned, what you mainly saw was kind of fear and division. It left me with a great deal of concern about where we're headed over the next few months.
So, Stephen, 4th of July makes me think of you. And why does it make me think of you? Because when did I meet you? I met you when the two of us were at a performance of 1776, everyone, in White River Junction, Vermont. And it was a community theater, and it had really a remarkable run, very packed. But one of the things they insisted on doing was that after the performance of the musical, they wanted a talk back with the audience. And Stephen Pimper and Arnie Arneson conducted one of the talk bands. And what I shared with Stephen, and I maybe even share with the audience, my daughter was protesting the performance of 1776 for exactly what Dean Spiliota said, that African Americans don't see 1776 or July 4th as a day of celebration because they were not included in that document. So Stephen, I all weekend long, I kept thinking of you because that was when we first met. And here I was doing a talk back as my daughter is like protesting outside. I love my family, but go on, Stephen.
I mean, I thought about that a little bit as well, in part because, you know, I mean, I'm historically the guy who July 4th, I reread the Declaration out loud. And I'm also the guy who has historically also read Douglass's What to the Slave is the 4th of July, right? So like Dean, I was also honestly sort of thrilled and heartened to see that perspective become part of the mainstream dialogue around the holiday. In thinking about Jefferson and the Declaration, right? I mean, if you go back and read it, right, it is literally articulating the right to revolution, and sitting at the heart of the right to revolution at the American Declaration of Independence is the recognition that government exists only to serve the interests of the collective population, and that right to preserve life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And the explicit claim of the Declaration, radical at the time, was that should at any point government be destructive of those most basic collective ends, it was the inherent human right of the population to overturn that government. And it is hard not to think in this particular moment of a government that is inarguably, I would like to say, although of course there are plenty of people who would argue it, that is not serving the most basic interests of the public right now. The other thing that I would just throw into the mix that also I think is interesting in this context is this weekend was also the debut of the filmed version of Hamilton. The musical, which has generated its own, I think, enormously fascinating conversation about that as a project of the founders as slave owners, as what it means to recast those roles with people of color. And there was a lot of sort of superficial discussion around that, but I also found a lot of really deep sort of thoughtful re-examining of what America means and has meant to different Americans. So I think that we're de-universalizing that story in a way that I think is really healthy.
Well, you know, Royal, I would read Langston Hughes' Let America Be America Again. That I would read that every year, forever. Mm-hmm. And then I also would pull a story out from a wonderful book called Rising from the Rails, about the story of the Black Pullman Porters, which was the first labor union, African-American labor union. And I'm looking at what's been happening, and especially this weekend where you see this stark contrast. In an interesting way, while Barack Obama was president, it never really emerged. It was sort of tapped down. There may have been an undercurrent of resentment. But starting with Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, I think you began to see this rise where Bernie was talking more about economic injustice, but who of course, you know, was at the epicenter of economic and social injustice with the African-American community, the Hispanic community. I mean, they knew his story because they lived it. You know, they hadn't lost something, they had never gotten something. I mean, I think that's kind of the frustration. So to a large extent, I look at George Floyd and I look at Donald Trump and I say, but for them. But I think it was ready to explode. Well, it was there.
Sitting here in Portugal, I'm getting to look the wrong way down the telescope at the 4th of July.
Okay.
You look in the big end and things look small down there. Yeah. But what I saw, I stood at Coimbra University on the campus. It was built in 1300, by the way, 1300.
That year.
The campus, okay. Where okay. The walls are still adorned with cartoons and sketches from the 69 uprising, a student uprising, where they filled this place with tens of thousands of students. It started a revolution. It grew from there. They were up against armored up soldiers, soldiers on horses, soldiers with tanks, soldiers with jeeps, no arms on the students. It started an uprising that remained peaceful, but spread through the country. And by 1974, the Carnation Revolution toppled Salazar.
Wow.
And I think that we may be at a point, it's not gonna be like toppling Salazar, but it's not unlike that. I mean, I'm thinking about these Warren Zevon song, a riff on that right now would be, I thought about everything that's happening. He would write, bring pharma, guns, and money. Not lawyers, guns, pharma, guns, and money. Pharma's gonna profit from COVID. We know that, that's gonna happen. Guns right now in America. Until we deal with guns, we have this horrible thing going on with police, but police also are the people who, they can't go anywhere without thinking the person they're gonna stop for domestic abuse, a traffic violation, is gonna have a gun.
Exactly.
That sets a tone. And money runs from our healthcare system, where if you don't have a job, for a lot of people now, you don't have healthcare. If you do have healthcare, it sucks.
Yeah.
And people are not paid well until there's a decent wage people can live on. And what's happening now is Republicans have successfully told the dark people, the white people, that the dark people are going to take their things, going to take their money. And I think people are coming together now and realizing, wait a minute, we're all getting screwed here.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And as I'm listening to you talking about this, I keep going back to something where the Republicans were really good at diverting attention and placing blame on those that actually hadn't caused the problem. And I've told this story before, and it really almost resonates now more than ever, where I remember when the welfare reform bill was going through Congress, and I was running for Congress in 1996, and I was opposing the welfare reform bill. You may have heard me tell the story, Dean. And I walked into Lisbon, New Hampshire, a dirt poor community. You know that, Royal. Lisbon, New Hampshire is very, very poor, struggling. It's always been that way, and it's been abandoned, all right, for the most part. And I walked into give a speech in Lisbon, New Hampshire, and I knew it was a setup because everybody was furious. As soon as I walked in the door, you could feel the anger in the room because Arnie was this liberal Democrat running for Congress. And some guy walked up to me and said, "We hate you." And I went, "Really? Have we met?" And the reason they hated me was they heard I opposed the welfare reform bill. And they were furious. And they said, "You don't get it, Arnie. We can't stand those welfare women. They get health care and we do not. They get food stamps and we do not. We work 60 and 70 hours a week and they get Head Start. We work 60 and 70 hours a week and they have this Medicaid program. We can't even afford our own health care." And they went through all the things that made them hate welfare, and therefore welfare reform is essential and I must be evil. And after listening to them talking, Royal, about how awful it was for them, and how all those welfare women, in this case, they can imagine them as being black or Hispanic, even though it might have been their neighbor in, you know, white Lisbon. I looked at them and I said, "You know, I'd be really furious too." I said, "But it doesn't sound like there's something wrong with welfare. It sounds like there's something wrong with work. When you can work, Dean, 70 hours or 60 hours a week and not be able to take your kid to a doctor because you don't have health care." Exactly. If you don't have health care, then guess what? It's not welfare, it's work. When you can work 60 and 70 hours a week and not know how you're going to pay the rent or pay the mortgage at the end of the month, it's not welfare. There's something wrong with work. That was 1996, Dean Spiliotis. But the diversion was so sophisticated and so effective that it worked. And now you're sort of seeing it now. And that's what Donald Trump's speech was on July 4th. It was a way of placing a blame as if these people caused it, when he knows full well why we're looking at this healthcare debacle, pandemic, economic debacle, what they're seeing with the instability. And it was about the diversion and not the truth.
Yeah, you know, I mean, well, this is, in some sense, this is a piece of the strategies Trump has used, both in 18, in which case it didn't particularly help him, the Republicans suffered a lot of defeats in 18, but to win in 2016, you know, the focus in 2016 was a bit more on immigration, but it's the same kind of, you know, using fear to divide and demonization of the other. This is just a somewhat different focus, you know, focus on kind of anarchy and protesting, and he's demonizing Black Lives Matter, et cetera. the question is going to be whether or not that's going to resonate with people. I think we have a different electorate. It'll certainly resonate with his base. But the question is it going to turn out enough people for him to put together a winning coalition? And we don't know the answer to that. The data doesn't look particularly good for him right now. But, you know, you get the sense that he kind of feels like this is really his only hand to play. This is kind of his standard playbook. And to try, and they've sort of tried initially to figure out a way to kind of link Biden into this. And, you know, initially they tried to argue that Biden was this kind of left-wing threat, and that didn't work pretty well. You could see from the data it was not catching on.
So then
they try to basically the round two was to say, well, okay, he's not one of them, but he's a puppet of them, and he's going to be unable to stop them. And there is an ad running right now that I saw that, you know, says if Joe Biden is going to be president, there's going to be all this chaos in the streets. So you tie that in with the law and order stuff. You basically, we know the arguments we're going to see from Trump.
Well, actually, there's a third argument, Stephen, could pair, and here's the third argument. So we have the first two. The third one is that he's senile. It's going to be the senility campaign with both Trump and Biden. The question is, you know, are they too old? Can they manage it? You know, and Donald Trump says, you know, I've got the best mind. I'm smarter than all my generals. I got the highest grades. I mean, there isn't, I don't know
I
how.
I got the worst Jews.
I mean, it's ridiculous. So, I mean, it's all these things. And I think the problem for him is that, interestingly enough, this is the Teflon candidate. Nothing really does stick to Joe Biden. I mean, part of the problem is that a lot of people are trying to figure out exactly what kind of a president he is, will be. They look at his past. They're wondering if it's a predictor of his present and his future. But in a funny way, he's kind of like this composite candidate, but you're not quite sure what you are getting. But what you know you're not getting is something that is a perpetual liar. That is, I mean, all the things that Trump is, at least you know Biden is not. That's about all you really know. He's almost the antidote to everything Trump is. What you get, you're not sure, but what you know is that he's nothing like Donald.
And, you know, it's unclear to me how much what and who Joe Biden is and is not matters in this particular moment, right? I mean, to some extent, right, most elections of incumbents are referenda on the incumbent to varying degrees. And they are also typically sort of people's individual assessment about how well they are doing. And if they conclude that, you know what, things are okay, they are inclined to reelect the incumbent. And if they feel that they're not, they're more inclined to go to the challenger. That's gross oversimplification of decades worth of research, but it tends to hold up pretty well up until February or March. Right. There were an awful lot of folks who said it's likely to be a close election because the economy is humming along, unemployment is at historically low rates, stock market is booming, yada, yada, yada. And the Trump campaign clearly had intended to run as that being the signature. And all of this other stuff, the culture war stuff, had faded a little bit into the background because it was, look what I've done, I'm a brilliant manager of the economy. Well, obviously, right, he's still trying to some degree, but can't run on that to anyone who is even minimally aware, right? So what's left?
Exactly.
All that's left, yeah, right, is the white nationalist, us versus them, the sort of, the literally sort of the traditionally fascist stuff, right? The paeans to the motherland. Right? This sort of this holding up the myth of what the motherland must and should be and how we must all gather round to protect her, right? But, cast in explicitly sort of racist nativist terms. I'm feeling hopeful today. I don't think it's going to work again with anything other than that narrow part of the base who will follow him off whatever cliff he's going to jump off.
But you know,
what is the other wall he wants to build?
Hold on, Royal, yes?
This is the other wall he wants to build. He wants to build a wall around the white motherland. That's what he's doing.
Yes. Exactly.
Come on in, folks. We'll rule from here.
The other reason I think to be even more hopeful, Stephen, is because of the overlay of what's going on in the country. I think that July 4th is a perfect time to notice it because the contradictions in our country's birth, the Declaration of Independence that we celebrate every July 4th says all people, well, actually says all men, are created equal. And then at the same time, the Constitution that underlies our country's laws says, no, actually, people who are Black are not even human beings, they're slaves, and we can continue to kidnap and bring slaves over here to work for another 20 years, and slave states that have slaves can continue to keep people in bondage. And after that, you know, for 230 years, African-American people, even after they're freed, have suffered mightily from a systemic racism that just underlies our whole economy. And now with after George Floyd's murder, people are in the streets, and even a lot of white people are recognizing that, oh yeah, I didn't realize just how awful the racial underpinnings of our society are. So I think that Joe Biden or Donald Trump aside, there is a huge awakening in this country that is not going to accept any of Donald Trump's nonsense.
Well, but the huge awakening, Royal, is in part because we're in the same boat. Too much unemployment, too much underemployment, too much homeschooling, too much illness, too much losing your health care. I mean, it's like it used to be the other people that had that problem. And now all of a sudden, all those stories about you're one paycheck away, or all those stories about the cost of COBRA, or all those stories. Well, that was a story that happened to those people. It didn't happen to me. And what the pandemic has given us is a bit of sort of economic Velcro, you know, and it's not good. Now you're afraid of your illness. Now you're afraid of your neighbor. Now you're afraid about your job and your paycheck. I mean, all these fears are coming together, and sort of the instability of this economy, the lack of a safety net for you, is now evidence of what Hispanics and Blacks have known forever, is that there isn't a safety net. You know, that's never really existed. Go on.
All that Trump is running into is his opposition to Black Lives Matter. His problem there is the wall he's running into is a lot of white people are saying, damn it, yes, they do. He wasn't expecting that.
But the reason he wasn't expecting that is that we've never really collectively said it the way we have now. There have always been pockets of outrage, Royal. You know that. And what he didn't realize was, one, the power of that 8 minutes and 46 seconds on top of everything else. I mean, again, you needed the undercurrents plus that 8 minutes and 46 seconds, plus the fact that we are home, plus the fact that we are afraid of losing our economy and losing our jobs and losing our lives. I mean, it was a cocktail that was made for this moment, which is just so shocking to me. All right, everyone, I need to go to a break. This is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Artis and producer Ken Barnes. It's our Rethink the Week. We're being joined by Royal Ford, Stephen Pimpare, and Dean Spiliotis. We'll be right back.
The sun is on the rise once again.
Welcome back to part two of the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. Again, Stephen Pimpare teaches at UNH. Dean Spiliotis teaches at Southern New Hampshire University. And Royal Ford is joining us from Portugal. He, for 30 years, nobody gets to work in journalism anymore, for 30 years, worked for the Boston Globe. So Royal, I'm going to start with you only because I saw this story. Now, we know that the EU has put together a list of countries that are allowed to visit the EU and a list of countries that are not allowed to come to the EU because of the pandemic and their inability to respond effectively. Some of the countries that are not able to fly into the EU are Russia, Brazil, and the United States. Well, there was a story that happened just the other day, and I just thought it was fascinating because I think rich white people thought when they said that the EU was not going to allow the United States in, that that didn't apply to them. And suddenly rich white people found out that it did apply to them. And it was a story of a private plane that was going to be flying into, was it Sardinia or something like that. And there were people from New Zealand on the plane. There was about maybe 12 or 13 people, but there were five Americans on the plane. The plane lands, I believe it's in Sardinia. And they go, no, you can't be here. And they're like, what do you mean we can't be here? And they're like, well, there are five Americans on this plane. They're not allowed to stay here. They're from America. The EU says they can't arrive. And they were like, I think everybody on that plane was like sort of shocked. Us? With all our wealth and our checks with commas in them and our private jet? Don't you get it? It's rich white people from the United States. And of course, what they ended up doing was going to, I guess, Great Britain. But as I read that story, it was so perfect because I think for the first time, it sort of sent a message to the very affluent in this country. We really are a SHIT whole country now. And you can thank Donald Trump for that because even their wealth and their private jet doesn't get them access, Royal Ford.
Even outside of this, people in Europe feel sorry for us. I mean, I said last week when we were talking that I have Brazilians tell me how bad they feel for the leadership I have as an American. Brazilians are complaining about American leadership. And yeah. look at the shithole they're in right now with that leadership. But the EU saying they're banning the flights is one thing. Individual countries can do what they want. So it's going to be a mishmash because it's every 2 weeks everybody reevaluates. Like right now, an American cannot fly into Portugal except for, and there are 19 reasons, if you're a student, if you've got the right work visa, if it's a family reunification, there are ways to do it. The thing that has struck me is that being here, I was thinking, boy, when can my friends and family come visit me? My decision now has become, do I even dare to go to America?
Yes, yes. No, Dean, my daughter's pregnant and she lives in Shanghai. And so we talk virtually every day. And it suddenly occurred to her that I may not be able to see her newborn baby when it arrives in November until 2021 or 2022. I mean, that's how long it's going to be because of the United States. And even with, you know, a change in election, I'm not sure that China is going to open its doors right away, even if it turns out that it's not Donald Trump and it's Joe Biden, in part because Joe Biden has had some interesting statements to make about China, too. So we're living in very, very precarious times. But I don't want to talk about China. I want to talk about Russia. So what's with this story about Russia and the fact that they had this bounty on American soldiers? Is it real? Is it Memrex? Does it matter whether it's real or is it Memrex? Was it in his presidential daily brief? Is really the story whether it's real or not, that he doesn't read the presidential daily brief, that it doesn't matter whether it was real or not, if it had to do with Russia, he wasn't going to pursue it anyway. I'm trying to figure out if this story has legs. What kind of legs are they?
Well, we're in the process of determining that. I mean, it is concerning on multiple levels. You know, it raises all kinds of bigger questions about how the president consumes intelligence. The White House has tried to make an argument that, well, they didn't bother him with it because it wasn't verified or confirmed. And plenty of other experts have said that that's typically not a reason not to bring something this important to the president. And we're hearing other reports of Trump getting very upset whenever intelligence briefers brought negative information about Russia to him.
Exactly.
So it's just opening a whole can. We already knew he didn't enjoy these briefings. He doesn't like them. They've reduced them to a couple times a week. They give him a lot of pictures because he doesn't like to read the books. He spends
like a comic book.
He spends most of the time talking about other things. It's just, I mean, it has sounded all along like it's highly problematic. And as with everything else with President Trump, you hear people say, well, okay, we know it's problematic. What if something serious happens? And we're seeing that now with the pandemic. It's problematic for him in terms of support within the military. There are a lot of veterans and a lot of military folks who are really upset about this. If this has been floating around and they haven't taken any action. So, it works on a number of levels as a story about just the fundamental dysfunction in not only the national security apparatus, but just a breakdown in the normal bureaucratic functioning of government. A lot of times when politicians paint with a broad brush about how the bureaucracy is a swamp, it obscures the fact that there are very important institutional functions that bureaucracies
exactly.
perform
exactly.
for presidents. And
exactly.
And this has become completely dysfunctional at this point.
Well, so Stephen, the one question I have is, so I was reading a speech by Joe Biden, and the speech by Joe Biden talked about how every day he would read the presidential daily brief that Barack Obama got. Now, necessarily...
I should hope so.
The president isn't obligated to share it with the VP, but because what Joe Biden brought to the table actually was his foreign policy chops. I mean, let's be honest. Why was he given Ukraine as an assignment? I mean, let's understand where that comes from. But he talked about how he read it all the time. And I'm thinking about Donald Trump, and they have to show him pictures and graphs, and not show up very often. It, you know, it needs to be more like a comic book or some sort of an entertainment piece, not really a presidential daily brief. Has any reporter asked Vice President Pence whether he had access to or read the presidential daily brief? Because what I did was I did a little homework, and up until the time that Donald Trump got sworn in, it was understood that Pence was reading the presidential daily briefs so that Donald could prepare for the inauguration, all right? But that was the last time I saw any mention of Pence and the PDB. But I am curious why no reporter has said to Vice President Pence, have you read it? Did you see it? Did you notify the president? Did you think that something should have been done? That piece seems to have evaporated, and yet to a large extent, Pence is tasked with certain things. You would think that he would be a go-to guy if there was a question about whether it actually was in the PDB.
I mean, it's an interesting question, and I do not know the answer
that
either. I do know that I have not seen a whole lot of reporting to suggest that Pence is among those that the president turns to regularly for advice. I have not seen a lot of reporting that suggests to me that the vice president, and you know, different presidents have different relationships with vice presidents and turn that job into different things. That in itself is not unusual. But I don't see an awful lot of evidence that Pence is involved with those conversations. And as a matter of the way in which those bureaucracies function in the way in which the law is structured, the vice president doesn't have any independent authority to weigh in and to make decisions. So if, again, God forbid we go to a world in which we do start to be inching towards something that looks more like a hot war in Afghanistan between the United States and Russia, right? They're gonna exercise their 1980s demons and their failed invasion of Afghanistan, and we're gonna try to work out our Vietnam demons, and we're going to wage a hot war, or India and Pakistan, or right. I mean, you know, as awful as the world is right now, right? This is the stuff that Dean was talking about, right? There are any number of things that could make this worse at any given moment. And what we do know is that the administration is not equipped to manage those well, and that you've seen this right in other contexts, right? We've got the State Department fighting internally with each other, with fighting with other agencies. We've got evidence of independent agencies trying to secretly coordinate so that they can do their jobs and stop horrible things from happening. I mean, if ever you wanted to make an argument to people about why competent governance was a thing that we should value and respect, I would like to give you the Trump administration as exhibit A.
Well, but Royal, what did Donald Trump refer to that he was sort of the general taking on the war? And what was the war? The war was on the pandemic. He was going to fight the virus. Right? And I'm going, well, how did that war work? Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm looking at going, well, he screwed that war up. Because
one thing on this Russia thing to keep in mind, yeah. Almost nobody has denied the substance. Everybody's arguing over the frame and the wreckage, the what's left in the wreck. The only substance deniers are Trump, Putin, and the Taliban. They're the only ones who say nothing happened.
Well, but so I'm reading all my lefty journals, and all my lefty journals are saying, well, it's all anonymous, the spies that they can't name. Whenever you hear them talking after having come from the skiff, they're not really sort of answering the questions. It appears to me that it one of the things that scares me is that it's being used by both some Democrats and some Republicans as a way to maintain our presence in Afghanistan, the longest war in American history. And that now they're going to use that as the reason to sort of stay there, as opposed to figure out how we sort of should begin to sort of back out. And that's convenient for both sides, whether it's true or not, Neil.
You have a point there.
But here's my question, because we were just talking about Vice President Pence. And the reason I brought him up, Stephen Pimpare, is that I wanted to turn to Royal and say, so is Donald Trump likely to resign? There's more and more questions about whether, I mean, he's always really hated the job. The only part of the job he really liked was, where he could go to Mount Rushmore, or he could go to Tulsa, or he could go here, and there would be the adoring crowds. But the crowds are getting kind of smaller.
Signing things. He likes signing things. That's pretty
exactly.
cool.
Exactly. So I'm just wondering, there's no upside between now and November. It all sucks. And it's getting worse by the moment. And this is a man who's done suck avoidance his whole life. He doesn't do responsibility well. He has no capacity to change. He wants everything to come his way. Everything is doing the opposite. And I am just trying to figure out whether he would resign and then basically get Vice President Pence to make sure that, he's pre-pardoned, that they could never go after him. Because frankly, the only way he won't end up before some sort of court of law or some kind of, possibly criminal situation is if he resigns and he gets pardoned by Pence.
That's true. I don't think Pence can pardon him for whatever's going to come from New York State, though.
That's a really good point. And that explains why Barr is trying to do everything he can.
Federal problems, but the Southern District is licking their chops when this guy's not in office.
Wow, I'm just trying to figure out what is the point in staying. And the problem is not only does he not like to lose, but give me one example between now and November of something that through Donald Trump's sort of perspective is positive. And I can't think of one thing. And knowing his limited, sort of smorgasbord of choices, there's nothing there.
There's a rally going on in South Carolina today, 2,000 boats on a lake in South Carolina. They're all Trump people, and they all claim they are part of this mass that you never hear from, and they're going to get out and vote. He sees that. He believes that. He relies on that. He thinks they're out there.
Yeah. Well, but Dean, as you're looking at this question of resignation, I think where he has to begin to realize is that every Republican governor that has been a toady for him, whether it was Governor Abbott, whether it's the governor of Florida, whether it's the governor in Oklahoma or in Kansas, they are now being set up to fail by his behavior. So in a lot of ways, his support system, his mini-me's, his mirrors are now failing gloriously because of his ineffective leadership and his inability to sort of stand up to understand how you got to coordinate with this pandemic. So to a large extent, he's actually feeding his own destruction, which is why I keep going back to resignation, because there's no safe harbor for him.
Florida and Texas and Arizona today, all three said, oops, too early.
Oops.
We listened to Trump.
Well, but Dean, too early.
Yeah.
It's not too early. There's no pandemic.
Not too early to open up.
Oh, no, I understand that, Royal, but yeah. Dean, he's moved on. There isn't a pandemic. We have to live with it.
That's true. It's over.
It's over, Dean. I mean, so we have to live with it. And my question then is, how do you live with something that's killing you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is interesting to watch his movement, with a few exceptions, is in general, particularly Governor Abbott, even Governor Ducey in Arizona, starting to kind of part ways with him on the need to take strong, you know, mitigating action. And even coming out and wearing masks, we've seen Pence now wearing a mask in public. And so, but it does not seem to have deterred Trump. As we know, rather than say, hey, you got a point, he doubles down and said yesterday that it's going to go away and 99% of these cases are harmless, I think he said. And so, 99%. So he's forging ahead. You know, the resignation meme, I've seen that popping up. A lot of people have been talking about it. It just doesn't seem to be the type of thing he would do. I mean, that in itself would be a recognition by him of failure or weakness. And he doesn't like to do that. So I think somewhere he probably thinks that, you know, he's got this set of tactics that he's used in the past. And I think he still believes at some level that it can work for him. And that this will, you know, if this can just blow over by, say, late August, early September, the economy's going to come roaring back. But as we know, the good job, the improved job numbers that we saw just recently, that's really based on the first part of June.
Yes, exactly.
It doesn't really account for the retrenchment we're now seeing at a number of these states. I mean, it's very disconcerting when you see the graph of where we are and the graph of where the European Union is, and, you know, the overall population size of the Union, European Union combined, is, you know, roughly similar to the U.S., not exactly. But, you know, the European Union now has, I think, a few thousand new cases a day, and we're up, you know, closing in on 60,000 new cases a day.
It's incredible. So
can I add something, Arnie,
yes,
about
the, of course,
the notion of whether he'll resign? I agree with Dean completely. I can't imagine a snowball's chance, you know, where that Trump would resign, because what he's in it for is his ego. And I remember people talking at the end of 2016 about whether he even wants to be president. He thought he'd lose and he's not going to take the job. Yeah, he doesn't particularly like being president, but he likes the adulation. And I think that we have to look at his decision-making in the future and in the past from the point of view of a junior high school student. I mean, what did your kids, or what would a junior high school kid do when confronted with this situation? Okay, you make up lies. There's, you know, it's not really a problem. And then when that doesn't work and you get caught, you make up some other nonsense. Oh, it's not everybody's getting sick and the economy is doing well somehow because Wall Street hasn't crashed yet. But it's like a kid, and it's not like he rationally thinks that he's correct, or that he rationally thinks necessarily that he's going to win the election based on the facts on the ground. He just is doing what a 14-year-old kid would do. Okay, I found a stick here. I'm going to poke it in your eye and try to win this fight.
Here's what I think, Steven. There are maybe 4 or 5 weeks left before the real you-know-what hits the fan. And what am I talking about? The whole question of school opening. And the reason why that is a huge problem for the president is that it is beyond complicated for a couple of reasons. One, what are you going to do about the kind of programs they're talking about putting in place? Alternative days, half days, what, yada, yada, yada. Because what we know in this country, and I have an article here about childcare. Well, childcare, Stephen Pimpare, was an issue for people who had kids after school, up till about age 12. We are now talking about every child up to age 12 or 13. Every parent who suddenly is going to have to be around to maybe homeschool. I mean, the whole issue of public education and childcare and the economy and going back to work and the pandemic, this is beyond explosive. It is beyond explosive. It is worse than just losing your job. It is worse than just losing your health care. It's what the hell do we do in the fall? And that has everyone on edge, because there is no real answer here. And the fact that our public education system might be imploding because of this is going to ripple out on every part of our society.
I mean, I think that's right. I think it is an enormously, impossibly complicated problem under the best of circumstances, with competent leadership at the national level helping to coordinate and ensuring that there's appropriate financing, yada, yada, right? And none of that is, of course, going on. Keep in mind also, sort of going back to Dean talking about the economy, the emergency unemployment benefits at the national level that Congress enacted expire at the end of this month. Mm-hmm. And that is right. So we've got formal unemployment levels now at 11%. Most labor economists said that's probably closer to 13 or 14%. Even folks within the Department of Labor say that something probably 3 percentage points higher is probably close to reality. That still gives us, right, sustained unemployment we haven't seen since the Great Depression, right? Before the sort of the reclosing of the economy that we are starting to see taking place because of the premature openings, right? So we're gonna, if we don't do something about that, we're gonna see much higher levels of poverty. We're gonna see even greater levels of unemployment. We're already starting to see eviction rates tick up in lots of places, because a lot of those emergency orders suspending evictions have now been lifted. So we're already seeing increased numbers of people showing up at emergency homeless shelters looking for assistance, right? Layer upon layer, add into this, right? If we don't, and you know, sort of public health experts are growing increasingly hysterical in the calm way they tend to demonstrate hysteria, right? But, you know, Fauci himself saying, yeah, we're looking at, you know, easy 100,000 cases a day creeping up probably by the end of the month. We know that that probably understates what's going on. So maybe that's 500,000 cases a day. We're already starting to see hospitals overflooded. The economy can't open back up. Schools can't open back up. Universities can't open back up.
Ah,
right. Yeah. I mean, it's just, again, it's like you think things are bad now. Oh, no. We ain't seen nothing yet.
Royal,
you're not even talking about the aftercare. I mean, we don't know how long these people who've survived, what kind of
absolutely
care
right
in the future. That could be huge.
Well, long-term disability is starting to appear to be a real thing.
Well, so one of the questions I had was, okay, well, they're going to cover you for the COVID test. And then they're talking about, we're going to cover you in case you get ill from COVID. Well, what we're finding out, Royal, as you just point out, is that there is long-term consequences to getting COVID, whether it's, you know, lung disease or heart disease or whatever it is, and the number of people that will be impacted by that. So if you're covering me for that, tell me why you don't have universal health care. Because by the time you're picking up all the tabs for all these different bills, from all these different consequences because of COVID, and then the progeny of COVID, because what we're hearing is COVID is not a one-off. We're going to get a variation of the COVID theme probably happening in 2 years. This, to me, is why you do some kind of universal health care, because you don't want a hodgepodge where some people are covered, some people are not, some people have to pay for it, some don't, some have out-of-pocket expenses, some don't. If there was ever a reason why to scoop everybody up and throw them in the same boat, it turns out it's now, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah, the time is now. I mean, it's, you know, Bernie was a little too far ahead, I thought, because people thought incorrectly that, well, there'd be enough jobs out there that, you know, we can get by with, if you're employed, you got health insurance, and I can accept that. It's exactly not happening anymore.
It is.
You know, they're learning the hard way that you can't tie your health coverage to your job.
It's again, because of the long-term consequences, who knows what kind of disability you'll have in order to get the next job, which clearly, if you are disabled, is it going to produce the same kind of revenue or income as the job that you probably lost? Last but not least, Dean Spiliotis, I just want to say something else. So we've been talking a lot about voting, and they're talking about, you know, absentee balloting, and they're talking about mail-in voting. And here's the problem I see. The problem is the same thing with public education. And here's the problem. You know, should you go to school every day? That's an easy answer. Should you go to school every other day? That becomes more complicated. What do you do on the alternative days? Should you be able to have some people vote by mail, but then some people show up to vote? Well, the problem is you don't want voices. What you want is one thing. Because as soon as you create choices, you create complexity and you create more opportunities for failure. And what we're seeing with public education and trying to figure out how to thread the needle, we're seeing with the whole voting thing. If I'm going to vote absentee, if I'm going to vote mail-in, but still you're going to have to prepare for people to show up and vote on election day, you're screwed. Mm-hmm. Because it's doubly complicated.
Yeah, I mean, I know we're short on time, but yeah, I mean, it's just immensely complex. It's a sort of odd version of federalism that has popped back up in a sense of, you know, the federal government, instead of saying, you know, we're gonna step in and provide uniformity and consistency, they're saying, okay, states, you figure it out.
Kids, have fun, enjoy yourselves.
Well,
that's not how it turns out.
Right. And on that note, I'm going to say, enjoy yourselves, gentlemen. Thank you so much. This is Artie Arneson. This is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Artie Arneson and Ken Barnes. This is our Rethink the Week. Thank you, Dean Spiliotis. Thank you, Stephen Pepere. And thank you, Royal Ford. And enjoy your time in Portugal. We'll be back tomorrow. Ciao.
Freedom and justice.
Salut, salam, salam, noir ou blanc, rouge ou jaune. N'y a pas beau qui aime, n'y a pas beau qui aime, mais n'y a pas y'a le nouveau. N'y a pas beau qui aime, n'y a pas beau qui aime, mais n'y a pas y'a le nouveau sac. N'y a pas beau qui aime, n'y a pas beau qui aime, mais n'y a pas y'a le nouveau sac.